and I appreciate it. But you and I both know that's not true. I'm not going to address specifics. You all know as much as you probably should about my past. It's legendary, Mr. C, Ding said. Clark scoffed. I'm being serious. So is he, Midas chimed in. The point I'm making, Clark said, is that I'm not going to lie and tell you nothing went on out there. But I'm not going to drill down on the details either. The sum total of all the unpleasant things I've done in the past should probably remain classified, or at the very least unspoken, for the good of all. That does not mean I don't admit it occurred. Dom knows some of it, but not all. Suffice it to say that I hashed everything out with Jerry. Here's the thing, and the chief reason I bring it up. Jerry Hendley is my boss. He did what bosses do, and that's between him and me. I am your boss. Anyone here decides to color outside the lines, you have to hash it out with me, not Jerry. And I gotta tell you, he's a hell of a lot more understanding than I am. Damn, boss, Midas said over the radio, the only one too far away for Clark to smack. You're getting me all choked up with this sweet sentiment. Never one to explain his explanation, Clark moved on. How is Lizanne?
I talked to her a few minutes ago, Adara said. She's at a comfortable hotel in Lisbon, chasing down a couple of Tylenol with some good Portuguese wine. Her wrist is broken in two places, and she's bummed that she can't be here. But she'll be fine. I was looking at the screenshot of Lucilla Fournier we got from the Snipe Nano. Not too much of a stretch to think Gaspar's thugs mistook Lizanne for the assassin. Same hair color? Pert build?
Ryan scrolled through the images on his phone. I can see it, he said. Ding hung his head.
I shouldn't have sent her out there, he said.
She's not up. Heat of battle, Clark said, raising his hand to put a stop to that kind of talk. She has plenty of training to ride along. Good job getting her out of there, Ryan.
Thanks, Jack said, kicking himself for leaving her alone in the first place. His track record with women was pretty dismal of late. It seemed like he picked girls who wanted to spy on him, were too busy spying for their own country, or were bona fide evil bitches. He was as red-blooded as the next guy, but had never considered himself a girl-in-every-port kind of guy. He wanted to settle down, date someone cool, someone pretty, someone sane.
Lizanne certainly fit that bill. But the idea of asking her out was ridiculous. That definitely qualified as coloring outside the lines. First of all, Clark would shoot him. Second, Clark would shoot him.
Chapter 11. Crescent wrench in hand, Sarah Porter stood up from a vain attempt at repairing the leaky pipe under the sink and watched her cell phone buzz across the kitchen countertop. She looked outside in time to watch three armored personnel carriers roll down her street. Cougars, they called them. She knew this because Rod had pointed it out to her during a Cameroonian military and police parade in downtown Yaoundé the weekend before. She shook her head as the heavy vehicles clinked and rumbled by. No wonder their roads were so crappy. She'd seen plenty of military vehicles over her husband's 21-year career as a Foreign Service officer. But she'd never been told they were called cougars, at least this kind. She chalked it up to her learn something new every day list, which grew exponentially each time Rod bid on a new country assignment. Cameroon was a promotion, at least on paper. Rod was the DCM, Deputy Chief of Mission, second to the ambassador. He'd run the political section in Croatia during the last tour. There had been a lot to love about that posting. Delicious food, the Adriatic, no cobras. But that's how Rod's career had worked out. Bid on and get a great post, then promote to one that was slightly less great. As a trailing spouse, the common term for following your diplomat other half around the globe, Sarah was used to it. Sort of.
The clatter outside stopped, but Sarah caught a glimpse of another cougar between the houses on the next street over.
She'd accidentally driven up on protests before, when the kids were little, and wondered if this was one of those.
Are you seeing this, Rod?
She muttered under her breath,
happy to have the comfortable heft of the crescent wrench in her hand as she leaned closer to the window to try and get a better look. The doorbell nearly caused her to pee her pants. She held the wrench behind her thigh and peeked out the front curtains to find Jun Kim, one of the spouses from the South Korean embassy. The Bastos district of Yeonde was a mini-United Nations, with diplomat families from the many embassies to Cameroon living and working in the area. June's pleading eyes darted from Sarah to the armored vehicles that now sat eerily silent at the end of the street. "Does your phone work?" Sarah put the wrench on the counter. Normally an introvert, she was suddenly happy to have company. "Come on in and I'll check. Any idea what's happening?" "I do not know," June said. "I was on the phone with my husband and it suddenly stopped working." She looked toward the street. "That's when I saw the troop carriers. I do not like this at all." "The embassy will know." She looked at her watch. "Rod's in a meeting right now. I'll call Post One and see what I can find out." She punched in the speed dial number for the embassy's main security post. Rod had told her and the kids early on that this was their version of 911 when they were overseas. She smiled as she waited for it to connect, hoping to calm her friend. "Sometimes it's good to be married to the deputy chief of mission. A fast busy." She tried the speed dial again. Still nothing. Kim turned for the door. "I will go to our embassy. It is probably nothing." "Probably," Sarah said. "But I'll walk with you anyway."
The two boys ran at the first sound of approaching army vehicles, diving between two houses, seeking cover behind a tattered boxwood shrub. They'd been watching a football game through the fence, unwilling to cross General Umbida's men, who were posted at the gates. The U.S. Embassy was across the street to the northeast. The embassies of South Korea and Tunisia were a few houses away behind them, the Saudi embassy across the street, half a block to the west of the U.S. compound. Jean-Claude was not quite 16, Lucien barely a year older. Stains of chicken blood and the preparation of a recent meal provided the only camouflage on their bright yellow t-shirts. The stucco houses on either side of the narrow alley would have been considered middle class in the United States. But here in Yaoundé, where many Cameroonians earned less than $2,000 a year, there were palaces. "Bientôt," Lucien whispered. Jean-Claude strained his ears. The rattling armored personnel carriers had stopped, leaving it quiet but for the periodic cheers and groans from the nearby football pitch and the cluck of a hen with her peeping chicks scratching in the dirt behind him. The air seemed heavy, charged with static. Lucien was right. Something was going to happen. Soon. The military trucks started up again, rattling their way toward the football pitch. Across the way, on the other side of the embassy fence, a Cameroonian man in a loose white shirt swept the sidewalk. The chancery was open now, receiving those who wanted to fill out paperwork for American visas. Jean-Claude watched the peeping chicks as they disappeared around the back of the house, and thought seriously about joining them. He watched the two U.S. Marines standing behind the embassy fence. They were young, perhaps just a few years older than he was. They looked more scrubbed than they did treacherous, though they stood ramrod straight, and there was an intensity in their faces that made Jean-Claude's stomach churn. He crouched lower, making sure the stubby palm tree hid his silhouette, checking quickly for any green mambas or button spiders, only slightly more frightening than the U.S. Marines. Jean-Claude peeked around the edge of the shrub. If the Marines saw him, they ignored him. And these men did not look like the type to ignore anyone. He wished he'd worn a better shirt.
"What do you think will happen?"
"I told you," Lucien said. "My brother's company will arrest General Mbida, and he will stand trial."
"But the Americans are right there," Jean-Claude said. "If Mbida is so friendly with them, will they not come to his aid?"
"Perhaps," Lucien said, "but my brother does not think so. He says they will be too worried about their own skins to face our military." Lucien's elder brother was a fusilier, Cameroon's version of the Marines across the street. He was loyal to the president, and well paid because of it.
"The Americans can't help but stick their noses where they are not welcome. The U.S. president is siding with Mbida to overthrow our elected president. My brother saw the video with his own eyes.
Jean-Claude scrunched up his nose in thought. If the general was going to mount a coup, why would he be on the football pitch with his sons? It makes no sense.
Lucien cuffed his younger friend on the side of the head. Stop thinking so hard. Maybe we can see my brother arrest the traitor.
A woman's terrified scream came from around the corner, followed by another, this one higher. Jean-Claude's sister had cried like that when a passing taxi had broken her hip. Lucien's shoulders began to tremble with excitement, so much so that Jean-Claude was afraid the Marines across the street would see the boxwood leaves shaking. Loud cracks and snaps filled the air as the armored vehicles drove directly through the wooden fence and onto the field. A voice boomed over a loudspeaker, ordering Mbida's men to lay down their weapons. The boys duck-walked between the houses, closer to the demolished fence, so they could get a better look. Jean-Claude heard a commotion and turned to see Mbida walking out of the chancery. That made more sense. His children were playing football across the street while he plotted with the Americans.
I think your brother did not have all the information about the general's whereabouts, Jean-Claude said, still smarting from the early smack to the side of his head.
Lucien cursed.
It does not matter. He will come out. They have his children.
Sporadic gunfire popped and cracked at the football pitch. Women screamed. Men shouted as more orders boomed from the loudspeaker. An instant later, three young women tore around the corner, running toward the embassy gate. Arms flailing, knees pumping, they ran as if chased by a wild beast. And indeed they were. A squad of about a dozen men ran after them. One of the men moved to shoot, but another swatted the rifle away. Jean-Claude was not a fusilier, but he was smart enough to know that firing at someone running toward the American embassy would be the same as firing at the American embassy, bringing the wrath of the U.S. Marines posted there.
General Mbida had run from the chancery steps to the gate and waved the girls forward, beckoning them to hurry inside with him.
All three of them were young, perhaps 14 or 15, and all wore T-shirts and shorts tight to their bodies. Boko Haram used children as suicide bombers along the Nigerian border. Even with the general standing right here, the Marines would never have let these girls near the gate if they'd had on clothing that could have hidden a bomb. The one in the lead was bleeding from a wound to her shoulder. As she ran closer, Jean-Claude could see her T-shirt was ripped. This was Mbida's eldest daughter. One of the Marines dropped to a knee and aimed his rifle at the pursuing fusiliers, while the other waved the girls through the gate. Lucien pounded his fist on the ground, cursing again. Americans must always play the hero.
One of the two armored MRAP vehicles rounded the corner now and came to a stop facing the embassy. A man in a colonel's uniform stood in the top hatch and spoke into a megaphone.
General Mbida is a criminal and a traitor wanted for crimes against his people. Send him out at once.
The Americans did not respond, so the colonel repeated himself. The Marines at the front post had moved behind a colonnade now. Their rifles were still at the ready, though not aimed at anything. The colonel surveyed the embassy with a pair of binoculars for a moment and turned to someone inside his armored vehicle before putting his hands over his ears. An instant later, the M2 50 caliber machine gun mounted on top of the Cougar fired three short bursts at the embassy roof, destroying the antenna arrays. The colonel spoke into the megaphone again.
You are harboring a known criminal. Send him out at once and we will stand down.
Jean-Claude heard women's voices next, yelling in angry English and something else, maybe Korean. A man barked orders. Doors slammed. The colonel ducked into his MRAP for a moment before stepping back up with the megaphone.
I say again, you must send out the traitor General Mbida without delay.
He paused for effect, gloating as if he now held the winning hand.
And please pass along a message to Deputy Chief of Mission Porter. His wife is being well taken care of. For now.
Chapter 12
The White House steward brought in a breakfast of steel-cut oats and fresh blueberries while Ryan showered and dressed. The cyan blue tie was a little too bright and too constricting for his taste, so Ryan decided to leave it on the bed until the last minute. Kathy assured him the tie matched well with his charcoal gray suit of worsted wool. A good fountain pen and a nice pair of cufflinks were about as far as his style sense went. Ryan kept a copy of the Wall Street Journal folded in his lap while he ate. Reading and eating were natural partners, feeding the mind and body, except at Kathy Ryan's table. But she'd stepped away to take a call from the hospital, so Jack had decided to cheat and wash down his morning meal with a little economic news. His late father, a detective with the Baltimore PD, had imbued in him a fierce work ethic, while his mother had given him an extra measure of guilt for doing anything that felt remotely like he was wasting time. He tossed the newspaper aside when he heard Kathy coming back in from the bedroom. She raised a suspicious brow, enough to let him know that he might be President of the United States, but she was the undisputed commander-in-chief at the breakfast table. The Secret Service special agent posted in the center hall of the residence could tell POTUS was on his way out before he opened the door. "Swordsman en route to the Oval," the agent said into the mic clipped to the collar of his shirt as the president stepped into the hallway, leather briefcase in hand. The response from the USSS Command Center was transmitted through the agent's earpiece and inaudible to Ryan. "Good morning, Nick," Ryan said. "How are the kids?" "Just fine, Mr. President," the agent said, stepping across the hall to enter the elevator. Ryan knew it was the only answer the agent could give, but it was important for him to know that the boss knew he had kids and that his wife worked as a nurse. Kindness came naturally to Jack Ryan, and he sought nothing in return. But on a purely strategic note, it was a smart tactic to treat the folks who had his back as if they were something more than furniture. He gave a polite nod to Andrea Young, the Secret Service Uniform Division officer posted outside the elevator on the ground floor. UD was everywhere inside the White House. Officer Young had tipped off Rear Admiral Jason Bailey, the physician to the president, that Ryan was on his way down. Dr. Bailey stepped out of his office across from the elevator and adjacent to the map room. He was a jovial man with dark hair, rosy cheeks, and deep lines around his eyes, as if he spent most of his day smiling. Bailey oversaw a staff of half a dozen other doctors and nurses that made up the White House medical unit, but he delegated little when it came to the president himself. If there was traveling to be done, Dr. Bailey was the one to go, staying near enough to Ryan that he could reach him quickly, but just far enough away that he would not be caught up in any catastrophic event that might render him unable to do his job. When Ryan was in the residence, Dr. Bailey braved the commuter traffic of Highway 50 from his own home in Annapolis so he could put eyes on his patient first thing in the morning when he stepped off the elevator.
"Good morning, Mr. President." Bailey raised a mug of peppermint tea as if to offer a toast. He canted his head to one side, giving Ryan a narrow eye, probing like a CT scan. "A little extra bounce in your step this morning."
"Is that so?"
Ryan shrugged, trying to keep a straight face as he thought about Kathy. The presidency really was a fishbowl. Ryan hung a right when he got off the elevator, stepping outside to continue his morning commute past the Rose Garden and along the colonnade to the Oval Office. He looked forward to the minute or two of fresh air and breeze. The Secret Service agent opened the door and stepped aside, posting outside the door. Ryan's principal secretary buzzed the intercom the moment he sat down at his desk.
"Good morning, Betty," he said, waiting a beat. She usually gave him a minute or two to settle in, so something had to be up.
"SAIC Montgomery is here. He'd like a few minutes before your 9 o'clock.
"By all means," Ryan said, scooting back from the resolute desk and rising to his feet.
Normally people stood when he came into the room, but Gary Montgomery was the special agent in charge of the Secret Service Presidential Protection Division, the hundreds of men and women who kept Ryan and his family safe. If Ryan was going to defer to anyone, it would be Montgomery. The SAIC of PPD came through the door. He was 48 years old, 6'3", and built like a linebacker. His dark suit was on the expensive side,
cut loose to allow for the Sig Sauer pistol and extra magazines on his belt. No desk jockey, boss. He had to be just as prepared as the most junior post-stander on the protective detail. Maybe more so. Montgomery had boxed at the University of Michigan, and apart from any athletic competition involving Ohio State, was generally mild-mannered. He possessed what Ryan's father had called quiet hands, and moved with the confident demeanor of a person whose abilities had been severely tested and found equal to the task. Competent, calm, unflappable. And he wasn't smiling. Ryan motioned to one of the chairs in front of his desk. "Morning, Gary."
"Good morning, Mr. President," Montgomery said, remaining on his feet and getting straight to the point. "As you know, Secret Service Protective Intelligence has search engine alerts set up on you, your family, and key members of your administration."
"That's got to be a load of fun to read," Ryan said, shaking his head. Montgomery glanced at his watch, the kind of glance that said he was in no mood for lighthearted banter. "A little over an hour ago, no fewer than 7 different websites, calling themselves news organizations, put up what are essentially 4 slightly different versions of the exact same..." Betty buzzed the intercom again.
"Sorry to interrupt, Mr. President, but D.N.I. Foley just arrived, along with Secretaries Burgess and DeHart. The Attorney General telephoned to say he is on his way."
The Oval's west door all but exploded off its hinges as Arnie Van Dam burst in. He wore a suit, but his bald head was flushed and sweating, as if he'd just stepped off an exercise bike.
It took a lot to rattle him, a savvy political operative.
He shot a hard look at Montgomery. "I assume you were here about..."
"I am," the agent said.
Jack Ryan leaned back in his chair and steepled his hands on his chest, index fingers pointing at his chin. He was the only one in the room sitting down, and judging from the way everyone else shuffled their feet, that wasn't about to change anytime soon.
"You all know Gary Montgomery, the agent in charge of my Secret Service detail," Ryan said. "He was just about to brief me on some information his Protective Intelligence Division has come up with."
The Director of National Intelligence looked at Montgomery.
"That crap on the internet?"
"Yes, ma'am," Montgomery said. Fiercely loyal, Mary Pat Foley was one of Ryan's closest confidants and friends, and as such, was prone to being a bit of a mother hen.
She'd moved up next to his desk as soon as she'd come into the Oval, as if to cover him with her wing. As Director of National Intelligence, Foley provided an umbrella of communication over the 16 intelligence agencies of the United States.
She'd been a case officer at CIA when Ryan was still an analyst, earning a well-deserved reputation as a crack intelligence operative, unafraid of getting her hands dirty with calculated risks. She gave the Secret Service agent a long look, sighed, and then took a half-step back from the desk, literally yielding the floor.
"Sir," Montgomery said, picking up the offered baton and running with it.
"An hour ago, several quasi-news sites put up a video purported to be of you talking to a small group of supporters in a Washington hotel."
"Purported?" Ryan mused.
"Yes, sir," Montgomery continued. "The voice and image sound and look like you, but it's definitely not you."
"The Secret Service would be in a position to know," Ryan said.
"What am I purported to be saying?"
"You're assuring those present that you were saving enough flu vaccine for those in your innermost circle, including the people you are addressing. The video is just a snippet, only 24 seconds long, but most of the websites quote unnamed sources that say more damning videos will be released soon."
Montgomery blinked hard, as if he had a bad tooth.
"The sites go on to accuse you of turning a blind eye to the flooding in Louisiana and the cholera outbreak there that they..."
Ryan sat up straighter.
"I'm going to stop you there, Gary."
He looked at Homeland Security Secretary DeHart.
"Cholera outbreak?"
"That's why I'm here, Mr. President. 3 cases as of 5 a.m. Central Time."
Bob Burgess, the Secretary of Defense, grimaced.
"Cholera? I thought we eradicated that in the U.S.
"Doesn't happen often," DeHart said. "Not since we figured out how to keep our water supply and sewage separate. That said, every major flood or hurricane poses some risk. The area where these cases hit is extremely poor, with a lot of folks still using well water and outhouses.
Burgess turned up his nose. Outhouses can't still be a thing.
You'd be surprised, DeHart said, turning to Ryan. FEMA personnel out of Baton Rouge are at the hospital now. A CDC team is en route. I'll have information for you within the hour.
But no one has died, Ryan asked. Not yet, DeHart said, his mouth set in a grim line. But two of the cases are children. The prognosis isn't good.
Ryan closed his eyes.
A cholera outbreak.
Not an outbreak, Van Damme said, glaring at Montgomery. Three cases.
I used the website's language, sir, Montgomery said.
Go on, Ryan said. What else does the website language say?
More accusations, Montgomery said. You supposedly have a team of personal assassins to carry out extrajudicial killings pursuant to the Ryan Doctrine. There's a lot of discussion about what they are calling a callous unwillingness to support the students in Iran against their oppressive regime. But the vaccine video is the most problematic as far as the Secret Service is concerned.
You mean the one that is the most likely to make people want to kill me?
To put it bluntly, Montgomery said, yes, Mr. President.
Van Damme slid a tablet computer across the desk.
I've got it pulled up if you want to take a look.
Ryan watched the 24 seconds of footage four times. He knew he'd never made such a speech, but even he would have said it was real.
This video is a clip from an address I gave to a group of public policy students at the University of Maryland a couple of years ago. I'm sure someone's thrown it up on YouTube. He slid the chief of staff back his tablet. The voice sounds like me, and my lips match the words being said, but as I recall, that particular speech was about European trade.
Unfortunately, Mary Pat said, it's getting all too easy to manipulate audio and video. Deepfake, or fake app, they call it. There are several types of software that do a believable job. We were playing with this tech several years ago at the agency. You just need an existing video and some audio files from which to get exemplars. An actor can then sit in front of a camera and microphone and read from a prepared script. The program inputs the mouth movements, facial expressions, and synthesized voice onto the target video. It's CGI and AI all rolled into one.
Should be easy to disprove, Ryan said, since the actual video is on YouTube.
That's the problem, Foley said. The real video makes you look good. The doctored one makes you look bad.
And you think people will believe the bad, Ryan said.
That's the way it works, sir, Van Damme said. Stir some bullshit in with the truth and the bullshit floats to the top. The muscles in his jaw tightened. The opening bell in New York won't ring for another hour, but the London Exchange is already in a free fall. Somebody believes it, and Senator Chadwick is helping things along by providing color commentary as events unfold. Her snarky tweets have already been retweeted thousands of times. This whole shitstorm has taken on a life of gargantuan proportions.
D.N.I. Foley made a face like she'd just eaten a whole lemon.
I wouldn't be surprised if she was behind this.
Chadwick, I mean.
I doubt even she would stoop this low, Ryan said.
Well, she's certainly piling on, Foley said, especially about the Persian Spring.
Is that what we're calling it now? Ryan asked, looking pained.
Well, she is, Foley said, and so is just about everyone else.
All of you have a seat, he said. I want to get into that.
Special Agent Montgomery braced.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'll be over at the Hoover Building this morning following up on this with a friend at the FBI. Special Agent Langford will be in charge here.
Gary, Ryan said, leaning forward with both elbows on the desk. And this goes for the rest of you as well. I can see full well that you've all got your blood up about these posts and Twitter's tweets. You're pissed. Hell, I'm pissed. But I'll remind you all that when our blood's up, it's easy to make mistakes. Mistakes the American people do not deserve. It goes without saying, but this internet garbage notwithstanding, neither the FBI nor the Secret Service is my private police force. We can't go around tossing senators in jail or throwing them off balconies just because they say mean things about me.
He was met with silent stares.
Understood?
Murmurs now,
but none from the heart.
Understood, Montgomery said. But I do have to protect you, Mr. President. And to do that, I need all the facts. Sometimes protective investigations aren't necessarily prosecutable, because lines get crossed.
Watch the lines. Ryan held up his hands. But I trust you.
Montgomery left through the door to the secretary's suite, pulling it shut softly behind him. Ryan called for a coffee service and joined the others in the center of the oval, taking his customary chair by the fireplace.
No balconies, Mary Pat Foley said. There was an unspoken pecking order in the group, and as President Ryan's oldest friend in the room, she nestled in at the end of the couch nearest him.
You sure about that?
Ryan turned to DeHart, the newest member of his cabinet. You'll have to excuse her, Mark.
I'm kidding. Foley smirked. But seriously, how do you feel about thumbscrews?
Ryan gave a wan smile. Let's talk about Iran, he said. Most of the stuff those websites said about me is bullshit. We all know that. But Senator Chadwick is right about one thing. I do have serious misgivings about this so-called Persian Spring. The chief of staff rolled his eyes.
Due respect, sir, but here we go again. The existing regime makes no bones about the fact that they hate us. Throwing U.S. support behind the protesters seems like a no-brainer.
I agree with Arnie, the SecDef said, but just this one time. Ryan tapped a pencil against the knee of his crossed leg.
The trouble with no-brainers, he said, is that they make it easy for us to stop using our brains. I'm not a big fan of that.
Can't argue there, Burgess said. I'm not saying we should follow blindly, but virtually all of our allies are falling in behind the protesters.
That's a true point, sir, Foley said. Ryan shook his head. There's something about this Reza Kazem character that rubs me the wrong way. He's a little too Rasputin-esque for my blood. I'd like your people to dig into him a little deeper.
Right away, Foley said. And speaking of Kazem, the Bureau puts him meeting with a Russian SVR operative in Crystal City 4 days ago.
Ryan chewed on the new information.
Which SVR operative?
A woman by the name of Elizaveta Bobkova, Foley said. She's registered as an economic attaché, but there's no doubt she's Russian intelligence. From what I hear, she's quite the up-and-comer in the Slujba Vneshni Razvedki. Mary Pat Kaminsky Foley's Russian was flawless, as was her intuition regarding Russian spies. According to the Bureau counter-intel guys, Senator Chadwick's aide saw the meeting.
Was this aide a party to it?
Foley shook her head.
Just a witness. They said he looked as surprised as they were. He definitely saw it, though, according to the agents.
Seems like sloppy tradecraft for an operative of Bobkova's caliber.
Maybe she wanted us to see her.
No word from the good senator's office? Ryan asked.
Foley shook her head.
Why am I not surprised?
Moscow backs the sitting regime in Tehran, DeHart said. Why would one of their intel types sit down with Kazem?
Hedging their bets, SecDef Burgess offered.
A couple of moderate mullahs are making noise about meeting with the protesting students.
I know I'm painting with a broad brush here, Ryan said. But in my experience, there are no moderate mullahs in Iran. There are hardline mullahs and practical mullahs, who were still hardline, but understand realpolitik enough to know that certain concessions have to be made for their regime to survive in the near term.
There is another possibility regarding Bobkova, Mary Pat said. We see Russia playing nice with Reza Kazem's group. We're more likely to jump on the bandwagon.
Not sure why they would want us to, but it plays into your hunch that something we don't know about is going on in the background.
That sounds about right, Ryan said. Bird dog this for me.
Foley nodded.
Of course.
With your permission, Mr. President, Van Damme said, I'd like to schedule another meeting on this topic tomorrow. Things are very nearly reaching the boiling point in Iran. We need to keep a weather eye.
Good idea. Ryan said. In the meantime, Mark, you'll check with your people in Louisiana, and Mary Pat, you'll get me more on Kazem and this Russian connection. There is something going on here that we aren't...
Betty buzzed in for the third time in the past 15 minutes. Commander Forrestal is here, Mr. President. He says it's urgent.
Very well, Ryan said into the intercom. The Deputy National Security Advisor, United States Navy Commander Robert Forrestal, stepped inside the door and snapped to attention, as he always did when he came into the Oval. He'd changed over from his winter blues to his summer white uniform just weeks before. Ryan thought Marine Corps dress was the classiest uniform that there was, but when it came to the Navy, the summer whites looked especially sharp.
Good morning, Robbie, Ryan said, and you too, Scott. The Secretary of State, Scott Adler, stepped in behind Commander Forrestal.
I'm guessing you're both here about the situation with the video.
The two men looked at each other as if surprised by the question. They both nodded.
Arnie showed me, Ryan said. I'm sure the networks have already picked it up.
CNN has it, Adler said.
Forrestal spoke next.
We have personnel in Garawa, in the northern part of the country, as well as air assets in Agadez, Niger. They are aware of the situation, and
Ryan frowned, throwing his hand up.
I think we're talking at cross purposes here. Start over, as if I don't know anything about this, because I sure as hell do not.
Cameroon, Mr. President, Forrestal said. President Njaya's troops have surrounded our embassy in Yaoundé.
Surrounded?
Arnie Van Dam put a hand on top of his bald head.
What the hell do you mean, surrounded?
Adler gave an exhausted shrug.
Encircled, Arnie. Swarmed. Bum-rushed.
He looked at Ryan. Any briefing in the Oval was meant for the President, not the Chief of Staff.
They were attacked, sir. No casualties reported, but we believe a Cameroonian general has taken refuge with his family in the Chancery.
We believe? Ryan asked, his voice dropping to a fierce whisper.
Cameroonian forces destroyed the satellite antennas and appear to be blocking cell transmissions. We're trying to re-establish communications now.
Ryan considered everything that had been said in the past few minutes.
He looked hard from Forrestal to Adler.
There was some miscommunication about a situation with a video when you first came in.
What video were you talking about?
The Secretary of State spoke next.
A video of you, Mr. President. You and General Mbida of the Cameroonian Army.
Ryan nodded. Mbida was in Washington 3 months ago, looking at colleges for his eldest daughter. We spoke briefly at an event.
I can't even remember where.
Kennedy Center, Adler said. You were both at the same performance of Rigoletto.
That's right. Ryan groaned. Kathy's doing.
I just spoke with him for a few moments during intermission.
It goes without saying that the video is not real, but in it, you were seen assuring General Mbida that you will back him in a coup against President Njaya.
All right, Ryan said. Let's get the rest of the principals in here. By that, he meant the principal members of the National Security Council. Those already present in the Oval were principal attendees, but an incident like this called for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, DCIA, and at the very least, White House Counsel. He looked at Foley.
Deepfake? That's what you called it?
Yes, sir.
Ryan tapped the pencil on his knee again, working through the possibilities. Two of these videos coming to light in a matter of hours can't be a coincidence. There's a state actor behind this, and I'm betting it's not Cameroon.
Chapter 13. It seemed like a great deal of commotion for one man to go fishing. A phalanx of black Zeal sedans and BMW motorcycles painted militia white and blue blocked each end of Bolshoi Kamini and Bolshoi Moskvoretsky, bridges crossing into the center of Moscow, snarling already horrendous traffic by forcing afternoon traffic to detour to the Ulitsa Krymsky to the west or Ustchiensky to the east. Apart from roving members of the Presidential Security Service, vehicles were now non-existent in the uppermost arc of the Moskva River south of the Kremlin. Snipers armed with modern Orsis T-5000 precision rifles parked themselves behind powerful scopes on either bridge, scanning the river and adjacent buildings as if their own lives depended on their vigilance.
militia patrol boats to the east and west halted all maritime traffic. A gaggle of heavily vetted journalists stood with their cameras and recorders on the other side of a rope line, 100 feet to the east along the concrete embankment. Russians in general thought it foolish to smile for no reason, but these men and women approached the assignment of watching the president of Russia with all the gusto of a press that was free to write exactly what it was told to write. Most of them smoked or drank strong tea from metal thermoses, paying only rudimentary attention to the two fishermen. Maxim Dudko stood on the bottom of the concrete steps leading down from the Sofiska embankment and cast his line with an expert flick of his wrist. He began to reel immediately, drawing a sideways glance from President Nikita Yermilov, who considered himself a purist with his $800 Orvis fly rod. Dudko found himself ever in the shadow of his former cohort at the KGB. But the shadow of the most powerful man in Russia could be a very comfortable place. For one, he got to go fishing within sight of the Archangel Cathedral's golden domes without having to fight for a spot with some idiot with a stick and piece of string. Dudko retrieved his lure, checked over his shoulder to make certain he didn't hook a roving security man, and then flicked another cast into the foamy brown water. He stopped reeling long enough to dab at his eyes with a tissue. The winds were from the south this afternoon, bringing the sour stench of sulfur dioxide and something that smelled a good deal like burned popcorn from the Gazprom refinery a scant 10 kilometers away inside the Moscow Ring Road. Yermilov stripped out a few more feet from his reel and began to flick his rod, placing the fly exactly in the center of the eddying current 7 or so meters upstream. Purist or not, one had to admit that the president was extremely good at the artistic side of fly fishing. Unfortunately for everyone, that did not mean he could catch fish.
What are you using today, Gospodin President?
Yermilov flicked the tip of his rod, whipping it back and forward and back and forward. He let the fly settle on the water for only a few seconds each time, certainly not enough time for a fish to even notice the thing.
My favorite violet leech, he said, a certain winner at this time of year.
Excellent, Dudko said, hooking his third perch of the afternoon. The president gave him a withering stare and then glanced quickly at the gaggle of press. They appeared to animate slightly each time a fish was landed.
And you, Yermilov said, a spinning rod of all things. With what monstrosity are you flailing the water today?
Dudko smiled. He hadn't survived this long without understanding the president's veiled meanings. They were so deep sometimes as to be positively subterranean. He gave an embarrassed shrug.
I am using a vibrating spoon. In truth, it is not altogether sporting.
He continued to reel, pausing for a beat as if mulling something over.
To be honest, he said, I would not mind giving that violet leech a try. If I might trouble you, my old friend.
He held out the spinning rod, silver spoon dangling, dripping water, and the tiny jawbone of his last catch. Yermilov passed him the fly rod without reeling in the line, causing no small amount of concern in Dudko that he might accidentally hook something before the president got the spinner in the water. It turned out to be a non-issue. Yermilov roared with glee at each fish he reeled in, even going so far as to school Dudko on the proper way to land each bream or roach.
Excellent, Maxim Timofeyevich. I must use this vibrating spoon in Irkutsk in July. The cisco fishing there is superb this year. With the added benefit that you can eat the fish, Dudko said.
Yermilov darkened.
What do you mean by that?
The PCBs, Gospodin President, Dudko said, wide-eyed now.
Mercury, other toxins. Any fish caught from the Moskva would be full of dangerous chemicals.
That is nonsense, and you know it, Yermilov scoffed, adding to the toxins in the water with a ball of spit he hawked from his throat. It is perfectly safe to eat fish caught in any waters in Russia.
Dudko gave the bobbing nod of the impotent.
I am sure it is, Gospodin President.
He had accompanied Yermilov on his annual fishing trip to Irkutsk to fish in Lake Baikal for the past 8 years. It was inexplicable that he would not be invited again this year. But if the president was going to issue an invitation, this would have been the perfect opportunity.
And then Dudko had had to make the incautious remark about eating fish from the Moscow River. How stupid of him. He knew Yermilov prided himself on the perfection of Mother Russia. Even her toxic fish. A murmur rose from the press gaggle, giving Dudko a moment's respite from the president's glare. A few of them looked at their mobile phones. Some took calls, nodding sternly, pretending that there was nothing even remotely as interesting in the world as watching the president of the Russian Federation catch fish that he was never going to eat. Yermilov reeled in another fish, this one a sickly-looking bream with a misshapen dorsal fin. He gave a toss of his head toward the press line.
What are they going on about?
The security officer nearest the journalists spoke to a woman behind a camera for a few moments, and then turned to stride quickly toward a more mature officer, the man in charge of the president's detail. This one wore a dark suit and buzzed hair that showed the rolls of pink scalp above his ears. Dudko had never seen someone with muscles in their head like Yermilov's lead agent. The elder security man listened intently, still scanning the area while the young man spoke in his ear, and then turned to approach Yermilov. He stopped some 10 feet away until the president let go of the rod long enough with one hand to motion him closer. The security man passed him a mobile phone, whispered a few short words, and then took a step back. Yermilov held the phone as far away from his eyes as possible with his free hand, turning away so the press could not get footage of him squinting. He continued to fish with the other free hand. A smile spread slowly across his face. No small thing for someone who believed smiles were generally the product of a weak mind. At length, he passed the spinning rod to the security man and turned to Dudko.
Let us walk.
Dudko complied at once, passing the president's Orvis to the same security man, who promptly handed off both rods to the junior member of his team. Yermilov showed the phone screen to Dudko as they walked west along the embankment toward Kamini Bridge.
What do you make of this?
Dudko scrolled through the article, waiting for the president to say what he made of the situation before chiming in. He might be able to recover from one slip, but not two.
There is a lot going on with the United States, Yermilov said.
Dudko offered to return the phone, but the president had read enough. Dudko slipped it into his vest.
President Ryan certainly has his hands full at the moment.
Yermilov stopped and gazed across the river, eyes half closed, the way he did when he was coming to some conclusion.
Operation Aniva, he said. This is a large step forward, Gospodin President, Dudko said.
He knew he had to tread carefully here, but the man did keep him around to offer some modicum of advice.
Nonsense, Yermilov said, turning to walk back toward the security team and the press gaggle, making it clear that there would be little more in the way of discussion.
Dudko had said exactly the wrong thing.
Think of it, Yermilov said. Floods, disease, an embassy under siege, and citizens who were finally aware of the great Jack Ryan's duplicitous ways. One of his own senators has accused him of going after political rivals. He is much too busy to bother with a little military exercise, even if it happens to involve Ukraine. And what can anyone do once we have control? It is rightfully ours in any case. We have our Russian citizens there to think of.
This is true, Dudko said. Yermilov stopped, peering directly into Dudko's eyes.
You believe me responsible, don't you?
As far as Yermilov was concerned, me and Rodina, Mother Russia, were one and the same.
It is not my place to think of such things, Dudko stammered,
almost hearing the doors to Lefortovo prison slam shut behind him.
No, Yermilov said, offering slightly more shoulder as he walked. It is not. I will tell you this, though. Our Black Sea bots would make short work of Ryan's reputation. Whether it is us or not, I am more than happy to take advantage of the situation.
Already drowning, Dudko threw away any flotation he had.
But President Ryan, sir, he already suspects our activities on the Internet.
Yermilov wagged his head from side to side. Jack Ryan will do what Jack Ryan will do.
Had the army of Russian Internet bots run out of various warehouse locations around the Black Sea been involved, Yermilov would surely know about it, for there was little that went on inside or outside Russia of which he was not aware.
Bylan the Bylan. Yermilov shrugged. Literally, there was not. The proverb more figuratively meant, let the chips fall where they may. It was a brash sentiment for the most powerful man in Russia, but had worked well for him up to this point. Besides, his own citizens are questioning his so-called Ryan doctrine for what it is, state-sponsored murder. They walked slowly along the river, reaching the security men again. Former KGB mongrel that he was, Yermilov was still a political animal. He took a moment to wave at the press before taking back his own fly rod.
I think there is a fish on there, Gospodin President, the young security officer said as he handed it off.
No, Yermilov said smugly. I am quite certain there is not.
A moment later, he began to fight a fish.
Look, he said to Dudko, ignoring the security man completely. I have caught another. Sorry to say, it will have to be the last. I have much to take care of.
Of course, Dudko said for at least the 100th time in the past hour.
That is a nice catch there, sir.
You take the fish, Yermilov said, holding the stringer up and foisting it on his aide so the media could see his generosity as well as his faith in the Moscow River.
You can tell me how they tasted tomorrow.
I will make some calls, Dudko said. Yermilov leaned away.
To whom?
The generals, Dudko said, to begin Operation Aniva. Yermilov waved away the thought.
Do not trouble yourself, Maxim Timofeyevich. Colonel Grokin will contact the necessary players.
Dudko paused, looking helplessly at the wall of stone that Yermilov's face had become. He bobbed his head again.
Of course, Gospodin President.
Dudko's guts twisted. The muscles in his face began to twitch, and he had to move his jaw to make them stop. And just like that, he was on the outside looking in, with that fool Colonel Grokin contacting the necessary players. And now the wily old yes-man would probably get an invitation to go fishing in Irkutsk as well. Dudko had to do something. A grand strategy that would bring him back into good standing. He was good at strategy. A master, really. That's why Yermilov had kept him around, wasn't it? He'd had a dry spell, that was all. But what to do now? This thing with the American president had some promise. There were Russian fingerprints all over it, though the Americans who hated Ryan had certainly kept the ball rolling, so to speak. Yes. This might provide a way back into Yermilov's good graces, if Dudko played his hand correctly.
By the time they climbed the concrete steps up the Sofiska embankment to Yermilov's waiting zeal, Dudko had begun to see the way before him. The armored sedan was set up in vis-a-vis fashion, and he started to climb into the rear-facing seats across from the president.
Yermilov stopped him.
You must take home your catch, he said. One of my men will give you a ride.
Yermilov gave a flick of his hand, like a cavalry officer signaling forward, and the motorcade sped away. Dudko found himself standing on the sidewalk with a plastic bucket full of fish, and a lone member of Yermilov's security team.
Your residence, Comrade Dudko? The young man asked.
Yes, of course, Dudko mumbled, preoccupied in the fog of his nascent plan that swirled in his head. This could work. He would make the call as soon as he dropped off the poison fish and returned to his office.
One of the benefits of being in the inner circle for so long was that he knew things about people.
Elizaveta Bobkova would not be happy about his proposal.
No,
She would yowl like a cat over a bathtub, trying everything to scratch and claw her way out. But what could she do? He knew too much about her, and as chief SVR officer of Washington Station, she had far too much to lose.
Chapter 14
President Ryan decided on a preliminary briefing while he waited for the rest of the NSC principals to arrive. Still in the Oval, he leaned back in his chair and closed his eyes, pulling up the image of West Africa. He'd always had a knack for geography, but the deployment of more and more American troops to join the hunt for Boko Haram terrorists had drawn lines in his mind that were crystal clear. Cameroon had more than its share of violence and corruption, not to mention a president who had done away with term limits and declared himself the winner of each election over the last 2 decades. But they were still ostensibly U.S. allies in the region. How many people do we have in the embassy? They're slotted for 51 direct hires, the Secretary of State said. Some of those are bound to be off at conferences or out of country on home leave. Many of the diplomatic corps live nearby, so some of them might even have gone home for lunch. Without communication from the embassy, I'm still trying to find out how many families are in country. I will know more on that before lunchtime here. Make it an hour, Ryan said. Adler folded his hands in front of his belt. I will, sir. There was no I'll do my best. That was a given. The prodding meant he could pass along to foreign service officers who worked for him that the President of the United States put their people, their families, as a top priority. Ryan groaned. All right, let's have it all, Robbie. The deputy national security advisor referred to his notes, making certain to get the facts straight in his bottom line up front brief. At 12:58 hours local time, State Department ops received a call from one of the administrative staff at our embassy in Yaoundé, stating that they were under siege by Cameroonian military forces. The connection was lost after approximately 45 seconds. The deputy chief of mission's wife, her name is Sarah Porter, was at home a few blocks away. She was apparently taken hostage by the military forces involved. Her condition or whereabouts is as of yet unknown. Apparently, General Mbida fled pursuing troops through the embassy gate along with at least one of his daughters. 6 armored Cameroonian military vehicles arrived just moments behind them, but remained outside the fence. That is all the information we got before contact was broken. Efforts to reestablish communication with anyone inside the embassy compound have proven fruitless to this point. Ryan leaned forward in his chair, mentally bracing himself for what was about to come next. Casualties? Unknown at this time, Mr. President. Contacts at the South Korean embassy report small arms fire. They're buttoned up tight for the moment, but they have dedicated an analyst to keep us up to date on what they're seeing, which up to now is not very much. Ryan said, let's open some back channels through neighboring countries. Get things rolling right away. We have DEA personnel in Lagos and Homeland Security in Accra, Forrestal said. One of my Annapolis classmates is an NCIS special agent stationed in Doula on the coast. I've reached out to him directly, but have yet to make contact. And the 278 men in Garawa to the north. Good work, Robbie, Ryan said, stifling a groan. He was groaning far too much lately, and didn't want to do it without thinking if the cameras happened to be rolling with hot mics. So that's the what. How about the why? This seems like a drastic overreaction to a grainy video. Forrestal looked at Scott Adler. His job was to brief and offer analysis when called upon to do so, but the embassy fell under Foggy Bottom's purview, and the commander was happy to let the Secretary of State jump in. We're still in the guessing stages, Adler said, but President Njaya has been hounding us to publicly take his side against the separatist movement in the English-speaking areas of the country. Okay, Ryan said. I realize we're early in the process here, but I need eyes on the ground, some kind of intelligence. What's the size of the Marine Guard force there? Forrestal glanced at his notes. He'd been briefing Ryan long enough to know he would ask about fellow Marines. The NCOIC and 5 watchstanders, he said.
Maybe they run a split shift, Ryan observed. Could be they're not all on duty. Find out the number for the NCOIC and for the Marine House in Cameroon.